From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The Catholic Church responds to Michigan's call for church investigators to let civil authorities deal with sexual assault cases involving priests.
We always defer to local law enforcement as to whether or not they want us involved or not involved.
Our political commentators talk about whether the legislature and the governor can work together.
They need to finish this legislative session saying, I accomplished something for the voters. The governor doesn't want to go through the first 2 years of her term and not have accomplished something on roads.
We wrap up this week's coverage of mental health services for children.
Mental health disorders are the most common disease related to childhood, more than cancer, diabetes, AIDS combined.
And Mardi Gras next week, we thought we'd take a second look at that spiked slushy in New Orleans called the Hurricane.
Made from this pre-packaged mix. It's bright red, it's super sweet. Bears pretty much no resemblance to the original.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Well, it's Friday. Let's check in with our political commentators at the top of the show here. We are joined by John Selleck. He is CEO of Lansing public relations firm Harbor Strategic. He was communications director for two Republican attorneys general and worked in Michigan governor offices and legislature. He's also been involved in Republican political campaigns, including the role of Michigan director of the Mitt Romney presidential campaign. Vicki Barnett is former mayor of Farmington Hills and is a former Democratic state legislator. Welcome to both of you. Let's get started with this. Last legislative session, lawmakers adopted a couple of citizen initiatives headed for the ballot. They would raise the minimum wage and require paid sick leave. Then the legislature changed them, phasing in a minimum wage over a much longer period of time, reducing the sick leave time, and exempting employers with fewer than 50 employees. Those laws are going into effect at the end of next month. The people who organized the ballot initiative say what the legislature did in its adopt and amend maneuver was unconstitutional. Republicans now want the Michigan Supreme Court to give them an advisory opinion on that. The Democrats want the Attorney General to offer an opinion. So, Vicki, what do you make of these requests?
Well, I think they're all fair, but this is still going to end up in litigation, no matter what the opinions happen to be. The Constitution is very silent on whether the legislature can adopt and amend, but is very clear on if the citizens adopt it, the legislature can't touch it until the next legislative session. So it's an open question, and I think eventually it's going to end up in the Supreme Court for litigation, not just for an advisory opinion.
John, your former employer, Bill Schuette, issued an opinion last year which said adopt and amend was legal, but that reversed an opinion issued by a previous attorney general. Could that reversal be reversed again?
Well, listening to the way you just described it, let me say my talking point that this is a big game of chess is more accurate than I thought. Look, we've got smart folks on both sides. The governor and her team are very smart. The legislative leaders, Shirky and Chatfield, are very smart. They're playing a game of 3D chess, and they're playing for keeps. And why is that? It's not just a power grab. It's a policy battle. The two sides are definitely spread far apart on the issue of the economy here. The Republicans and the business leaders with those folks want to keep the gains of the last 8 years moving forward. The Democrats want to see the pendulum swing in a different direction. On top of that, this pressure that's coming down from the national side. It used to say that all politics was local. Now all politics is becoming national, and we've never seen a more polarized, nasty drag-out fight that's taking place at the national level. That pressure is coming down here. In this instance, I'd probably say the institution of the governor has the advantage. She's a single statewide voice versus many voices of many legislators. Shirky and Chatfield are doing a very good job trying to stay unified and as a voice back against the governor. But, you know, the other advantage the governor has is, as you just mentioned, she's got the attorney general on her side. And I'd say the legislature looking for an opinion from the Supreme Court is a strong indication they don't feel the attorney general is going to go their way.
We talked for a while last Friday about the Department of Environmental Quality restructuring that was proposed by Governor Gretchen Whitmer and turned down by the legislature. Since then, Whitmer's introduced a new plan. How much has this rift been about substantive policy differences, and how much of this is about politics and power? Vicki?
Well, it all comes down to policy in the end, whether it's about power or not. And in this case, the addition of industry panels to oversee decisions made by the Department of Environmental Quality really hurts the ability of the department to make policy that goes in the direction of protecting the environment. And I think that the governor did the right thing right now by proposing a reorganization and leaving those panels in place. She's going to have to learn how to deal with them because they were passed by legislation last term. But she can require that the legislature deal with specific rules regarding those panels to make sure that they meet on time in a timely fashion, that there's an appeals process in place, which would go to an administrative law judge, and to see if that can be done on a timely manner. So I think she's showing right now that she's willing to work with the Republicans in the House and the Senate, and she sent a clear message that she still wants to reorganize the department. And so I think this was a good move on her part. I hope the legislature takes that as an olive branch and begins to work more closely with her.
The governor's team is smart, and they attempted to exercise their power. They didn't do two separate EOs, where they could have put one with the general reorg of the departments. I don't think the legislature would have had any problem with that. And then a separate one covering the battle over these panels. And she knows that they were going to oppose that. And so she put it all into one to see if she could use rhetoric that would make them look like they were against clean water. And it didn't work. And that's all right. This is a good process for each side to see that they're willing to use all the levers of power. Like I said earlier, it is a big chess game. And actually, what's encouraging to me, it's been a war of wits in using the rules. It's not been a war of words. And that's a plus for what the relationship's going to be going forward. And I think they're looking ahead. And if I really generalize, Lester, and said that all policy legislation is going to go into two buckets in this divided government era, one bucket's going to be all the areas where they don't really agree, and there's likely to be some battles back and forth. I don't call them fights because I don't see this as having been a fight yet. The other bucket is going to be some issues where they are on the same page as far as they need to get something done. They need to finish this legislative session saying, I accomplished something for the voters. The governor doesn't want to go through the first 2 years of her term and not have accomplished something on roads. So in that bucket of getting done things that have to get done, I would say roads have to be in that bucket for absolutely sure. I could probably also throw in skilled trades and auto insurance. Those are things that have to get done. So they are reserving the war of words thus far because they know they still need to come together and find answers on those other issues. The other part that's the clock is ticking loudly. It used to be you could pass legislation in the quote off year and that not a whole lot got done in the election year. The problem is with the presidential year and the way that all politics is now national, Elizabeth Warren jumped into the presidential race in December 27.
Yeah, there's no off year anymore.
There is no year. The clock's ticking. So they may only have until the end of the summer or the beginning of the fall to get any of these things done.
Let me switch up topics on you. The Citizens Research Council of Michigan came out with a report this week which suggested we could be facing a teacher shortage. In part, the report said, quote, enrollment in teacher prep programs in Michigan colleges and universities has been falling for some time by 66% over the recent 7-year period. This is compounded because the number of program completers and the number of individuals who obtain state certification in specific subject areas are down as well. Vicki, what should elected officials do with that information?
They should stop demonizing teachers. That's been a real problem for the last decade. Once we hit the economic downturn, the legislature decided it was fine to go in and start to micromanage the education field and gut teachers' pensions and health care plans and make it very difficult for teachers to do their jobs by turning them into test providers instead of educators. And nobody wants to work necessarily in that kind of environment. Then you had added to that cuts in the education budget going forward, a lower per pupil funding level, the addition of charter schools, which didn't require the same pay level. And all the while, you still have teachers who have to get master's degrees. Well, if you're a student and you want to go into education, and the real shortage is in STEM education, and you're going into the sciences, you're much better off getting your degree, your bachelor's degree, and then your master's degree, which is required eventually as a teacher, and go into the private sector and earn way more money without all of these micromanaging hassles. And that's where the problem comes in. When we made it so difficult for teachers to teach and still required them to pay for their master's degree in order to keep their teaching certificate, we gutted their pensions and we gutted their salary, and then we went after their health care, the benefits no longer outweighed the working environment. And so we are looking at a teacher shortage, especially in the STEM fields with science, education, math, and engineering. And those people are going into the private sector where they don't have any of these other problems. And when we say that somebody starts out at a salary of $36,000 and then eventually goes up to $67,000, which is the average for a teacher after several years, $67,000 is way lower than an engineering scientist can make in the private sector. And that's where the problem comes in. We have priced teachers, those good students, out of the teaching field. And we have to find a way to lure them back by increasing their options, their benefits, lowering the per pupil count in a classroom, and making sure that we value teachers as the professionals that they are.
John, what would you advise legislators or the governor to do about potential teacher shortages?
Well, going hand in hand when you read about this topic online right now, what's even more scary to me is the loss of students that we're seeing declining enrollment across the board. And that's a huge problem for Michigan going forward, is just even having the people to grow our economy and grow our state. But frankly, in the bigger picture, it's not just the legislator's job. It's everybody's job. It's that important. Education equals a successful state and a growing Michigan economy. It's going to be the job. Everyone's going to have to pitch in. The universities are going to have to market more attractive educational opportunities for teachers. Administrators are going to have to ensure that we have attractive working environments for the students. The school boards and the legislature are going to have to ensure that the billions already going into the mix are actually being spent where they need to, priority-wise. And it's clearly going to be the job of the legislature and the governor to find more creative solutions that are cost-effective as well, such as, you know, attracting people to become teachers in areas of need by repaying student loans, or allowing experts in certain fields that we need it to teach without having gone through the traditional teaching training system, or increasing the ability for students that want to go into skilled trades to spend time as apprentices during high school instead of being in a classroom. There's a lot of possibilities. I went to public schools. I've got four kids in public schools. We all know that a teacher, a good teacher, makes the biggest impact. And Michigan is searching for an answer to its low scores. Well-equipped, good teachers are going to be one of the biggest changes or one of the improvements that we can make. That's also going to make the field more attractive. But the bottom line is the governor has indicated clearly that education is a top priority of hers. I fully expect we are going to see a large in-depth discussion in Lansing about education this year.
That is John Selicky, CEO of the public relations firm Harbor Strategic. He's worked with Republican attorneys general in the governor's office and in the legislature. Thanks for joining us this week, John.
Thank you for having me.
And of course, Vicki Barnett is a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic state legislator. Thanks, Vicki.
Thank you. It's been fun.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The recently passed Farm Bill now makes it legal to grow hemp. It's been unlawful to grow it since 1937. Hemp is a marijuana plant, but it contains far less THC, the stuff that gets you high, or maybe not you, but gets people high. While hemp fibers can be used in a variety of ways, another product from hemp is CBD oil. Here to tell us more about CBD and legal restrictions is Denise Policella. Sorry about that. She's the founder and managing partner of Cannabis Attorneys of Michigan. Welcome.
Thank you.
Let's start out with a simple definition. What is CBD oil?
So CBD oil is the extracted form of CBD, which is a derivative or one of the many, many, many components of the cannabis sativa L plant. Most of us know it by the name marijuana. And one of the more popular components of the cannabis or marijuana plant is THC. We all know that one. THC is the component in marijuana that tends to make people high. That's the psychoactive component. CBDs, or cannabidols, is one of the most common other ingredients, and now one of the more well-known ingredients in the cannabis plant, in marijuana. The interesting part about CBD is that it has healing properties, as we're discovering more and more, but it does not get you high. And the interesting thing about CBD is that we've been able to start extracting CBDs from industrial hemp plants as well as from marijuana plants. Now, the distinction between marijuana and hemp is generally that they both come from the cannabis plant. They're both strains of the cannabis plant. But marijuana is more commonly grown to create marijuana, the smokable marijuana with THC in it, where industrial hemp has been used for generations for things like clothing and rope and the interior of car doors and breakfast cereal and vitamins. So now we're deriving an oil form of CBD extract from industrial hemp and using it for a lot of medical purposes.
Well, it's become a popular natural remedy for all kinds of ailments, including anxiety, seizures, pain. But I'm wondering, have any of those claims actually been scientifically verified?
Well, they've been verified over in Israel, and you'll find that Israel has done the lion's share of the medical research on all of the cannabis plant and is doing research that is, frankly, leaps and bounds ahead of where we are in the United States. However, we do have universities here, and our U.S. government here, including also the World Health Organization, have started studying the entirety of the cannabis plant. And they have acknowledged that CBDs do have healing properties. But most of the statements that you will find coming from any source within the United States is that simply more studies are needed, which is great because we've recently legalized hemp, and hopefully that will clear the way for these studies.
Why has CBD oil become so popular? I mean, I started looking it up on the net, and there were all kinds of products available and all kinds of claims about the products. And it made me a little skeptical, I got to tell you, just because they seem to be a bit too effusive about the properties.
Sure. Well, that's good marketing, of course. But I think there are two reasons that CBDs have become so popular. The first reason is that people see these as a way around marijuana prohibition. Because CBDs are extracted from primarily industrial hemp products, and industrial hemp has been able to be imported into the United States for many years now, as long as you can get hold of some industrial hemp and you have that license and you're able to extract those CBDs, there's no real reason for anyone to think that those CBDs are illegal. So people have been freely creating and trading those across state boundaries through the mail for a long time now, sort of making the assumption that they're legal because they come from industrial hemp, which, if properly imported into the United States with a license, is legal. I also think that there has been significant anecdotal evidence of CBDs having actual healing properties, particularly with pediatric seizures and a lot of parents who have tried CBD with their children who have any kind of seizure disorder have seen potentially, in many cases, a lot of success. And that kind of research and that kind of result, even though it's anecdotal and not really based in scientific research, that kind of news spreads when you're talking about a seizure disorder. And then, of course, we have the internet, so we spread it faster.
I want to get to some of the legalities of growing hemp in Michigan and what CBD is considered, but I've got one more question about the regulation of CBD. Is it subject to the Food and Drug Administration regulations? Has it received FDA approval for anything?
There has been one FDA-approved CBD-based medicine for pediatric seizures. So those would be for folks with epilepsy and that kind of thing. Other than that, I'm not aware of any.
Under the Farm Bill, CBD oil is to be treated like any other hemp product. How does that square with Michigan law?
Right. So here's the thing, and this is why it's so confusing for everybody. Most folks have been making the assumption that CBD has been legal this whole time, while the federal government has continued to maintain that CBDs are still a controlled substance. There are articles out there today, and there has been a statement from the federal government that CBDs are still considered a controlled substance. I don't know how that's really possible in light of the Farm Bill's legalization of industrial hemp, because the definition of industrial hemp that they made legal contains concentrates, derivatives, extracts, and truly every part of the industrial hemp plant. I don't see how the federal government can have it both ways at this point. As far as Michigan is concerned, we had a recent flurry of legislation. And it started with Prop 1, which isn't actually legislation, but that started us off in Michigan last year. On November 6th, Proposal 1 was passed by the people of Michigan that legalized industrial hemp. But rapidly after that, you had the U.S. Farm Bill passed, which also legalized industrial hemp at the federal level and gave all of the regulation and licensing of industrial hemp and industrial hemp-derived products, presumably CBD, over to the Michigan Department of Agriculture and Rural Development. So it looks like even though CBDs are completely legal in Michigan now, that they're also completely regulated by the Department of Agriculture.
And that's another thing I wanted to get to. There's a Michigan law that goes into effect in March. It also calls for CBD oil to be treated like hemp. But hemp is regulated by the Michigan Department of Ag, as you said. Michigan's Department of Licensing and Regulatory Affairs oversees medical and recreational marijuana. What's that mean for CBD oil?
Correct. So two of the bills that passed on December 21st through the Michigan legislature tie the production of hemp by licensed hemp producers and growers into licensing and regulatory affairs' regulation of medical marijuana facilities. Processing facilities will be able to process industrial hemp that they receive from licensed hemp producers, and provisioning centers, which many people simply call dispensaries, will be able to dispense the industrial hemp-derived or processed products from the processors directly to Michigan patients. They will also be able to use, and by they I mean the industrial hemp producers, will also be able to use the laboratories or secured, safety compliance facilities and the secured transporters that are licensed through the Medical Marijuana Facilities Licensing Act for the testing and transportation of industrial hemp. So the three bills that passed the legislature on December 21st, the first one making industrial hemp legal for research and development purposes. So that would be the Michigan Industrial Hemp Research and Development Act of 2018, quite a mouthful. And then the two bills that were tie-barred to that bill tie the industrial hemp under MDARD and that cultivation into the Facilities Licensing Act and the production and retail distribution. It's complex.
We should say that farmers, by the way, can't just decide, okay, I'm growing hemp next year. They like you said, they have to be licensed. They're going to be regulated. They have to register with the government. And we don't have that system set up in place yet. So it's not likely that farmers will be planting industrial hemp in Michigan this year, is it?
I would like to think that they will be able to by then. If you go to the Department of Agriculture website at the state of Michigan, right now it says that they don't have anything available. Part of that is because they haven't had their plan approved by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And then the other part of that is because the U.S. government's currently shut down. So the page simply says, we don't know when we're going to have anything for you. I really hope, considering the fact that the people of Michigan did legalize industrial hemp through Proposal 1, that the state makes every effort to try to get something available for farmers this year, because my phone's ringing off the hook with people wanting to throw hemp seeds into the ground in April or May. So I have a feeling that considering the fact that everyone thinks it's legal right now, they may still do it anyway.
Well, what are the things that people should be concerned about as far as legalization of hemp and CBD oils?
My caution to folks would be, before you throw hemp seeds into the ground, simply continue to monitor the Michigan Department of Agriculture's website and more or less follow that. Try to engage with them as soon as possible and take a look at their website for when an application comes online. I know that it's very confusing right now. Even as an attorney, it's been quite a challenge to unravel these five or six laws that came in rapid succession. I can't imagine how it is for a layperson. And then when you look out and see CBDs being advertised and sold all over the place, all over the internet, it is incredible to me to think about how they're going to try to get their arms around enforcing this. So, simply just a note of caution before you run out and start a CBD business or start an industrial hemp farm, just check with the state of Michigan.
Denise Policella, she's the founder and managing partner of Cannabis Attorneys Michigan, Policella and Associates. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
We recorded that interview a while back, and we've got some updates. Let me tell you about that. CBD is already being added to coffee, cocktails, even dog treats. And like we said earlier, it won't get you high, but some people believe it has calming effects. Recently, some bars in Detroit jumped on the trend and began offering drinks made with CBD-infused soda. The Detroit Health Department caught wind of that and told the establishments, stop selling CBD-infused drinks. As we just heard in this interview, CBD is produced from hemp or marijuana plants and is not yet an approved food additive by the Michigan Department of Agriculture and Rural Development or the Food and Drug Administration. According to the Michigan food law, unapproved food ingredients cannot be added to food that is sold at restaurants. The Detroit Health Department says after their inspection, the restaurants voluntarily agreed to stop offering the product.
Cheers.
Cheers. Cheers.
Good thing we're not taking video, Lester.
You're having some trouble with that one.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings, having a little problem with her hand-cranked vintage ice crusher, but looks like you got through that okay. What are you making?
A couple weeks ago, we were talking about rum. We made that nightcap cocktail, and I said there wasn't really a Michigan rum that had a depth of flavor that I was looking for. And then I realized that I had forgotten about a Michigan rum that we haven't played with on the show before.
And what's that?
Well, it's a Michigan rum by way of Jamaica. It's called Dr. Bird Jamaican Rum, and it is from Two James Distillery in Detroit. And what they've done, since it's really hard to make a deeply funky Caribbean-style rum in a state that doesn't grow sugarcane and doesn't have that kind of climate, is that they've bought up a variety of barrels of rum from Jamaica. They're bringing it up here, they're blending it, they're aging it, and then they're producing their own unique spin on a Jamaican rum.
Oh, that's clever. Well, that's nice to add to the list. What are you going to use that in?
Well, Mardi Gras is coming up. I'm seeing punchkis all over the grocery store shelves. And so I thought let's take this in a bit of a New Orleans spin and make a hurricane.
Oh, I've had a hurricane in New Orleans, at least a sip of one from my friend, and it was horrible.
And this is going to taste nothing like that. So the story of the hurricane is actually a really fun one. In the 1940s, Pat O'Brien's bar wanted to buy whiskey, and their distributor wouldn't sell them any whiskey unless they would buy a case of rum for each case of whiskey that they purchased. And so they had to figure out something to do with all of this rum. And that's when the hurricane came around. And it was a huge drink. I mean, the original recipe calls for 4 ounces of rum because they were really trying to blow through it and to use it up. Over the years, the recipe has changed a lot. And now what you get in New Orleans is made from this prepackaged mix. It's bright red. It's super sweet. Bears pretty much no resemblance to the original or what we think the original is. Today, I've made a recipe from Jeff Beachbum Berry, who's a tiki drink historian. And this is his take on what an original hurricane might have tasted like.
Well, looks nice. It's pretty. It's not red. That's a good thing, I suppose. How'd you make this?
So as I say, the original recipe called for 4 ounces of rum. We have cut this in half to make a slightly more reasonable sized beverage. So I used 1 ounce of the Dr. Bird rum, which is really funky, estery. There's a term in rum called hogu, which refers to that kind of rum funk. And this has rum funk to the max. And because it had so much of that funk, I wanted to temper it a little bit. So I also used 1 ounce of the New Holland barrel rum that we've featured a few times before, because it's a little bit softer, a little bit sweeter, a little bit rounder.
So you have 2 rums in this drink.
Which is a classic tiki tradition. It was very common to blend multiple rums to create the flavor profile that you're looking for, which is what we've done here. Then to go with that, there's 1 ounce of a passion fruit syrup and 1 ounce of lemon juice.
That's it?
That's it.
And a lot of ice.
And a lot of crushed ice, exactly.
So passion fruit syrup, how do you make that?
Well, you can purchase it. Mostly online is the easiest place to find it these days, but you can also make your own. So if you have a Mexican market near you, check in the freezer section and see if they sell passion fruit pulp. And then it's just a matter of mixing that passion fruit pulp with a rich, simple syrup, which has 2 parts sugar to 1 part water. And it's going to make this really nice, fruity sweetener for your drink.
Do you strain it or anything? You said pulp.
The pulp comes frozen, and then you're going to thaw it out. And it comes out pretty smooth, but you could always strain it out a little bit. We'll put a recipe up on the site.
All right. Well,
you've got an umbrella in this drink, and I'm not the kind of guy who really embraces umbrella drinks, although you've fooled me with a couple of tiki drinks before, so I'm going to try this. Oh, it smells fruity. You can smell something different about the rum, too. That's not the hurricane I had in New Orleans.
No, definitely not. But did you like it?
I did. You know, I'm not a big rum fan, but this has a nice balance. This passion fruit syrup seems to work really well with the two rums that you've gotten here.
Well, I love rum. I have about 20 different bottles of rum on my shelf right now, and I love all of them in different ways. So you can give all the rum you don't like to me, Lester.
Okay, that's a deal. Cheers.
Cheers.
You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. The shortage of mental health services for children in Michigan is reaching a crisis point. That's what we've been hearing all week from providers, parents, and advocates. But there's a movement to bring about real change for families. Here's what Dr. Sheila Marcus, clinical professor of child and adolescent psychiatry at the University of Michigan, told us yesterday on Stateside.
I think that this is a crisis that is beginning to reach the highest levels, both within the state, within the university, within academic centers, and within primary care centers. And people are beginning to put their heads together to say, this isn't right, this isn't fair, it's not good for these parents, it's not good for these children.
A new coalition of organizations and advocates in Southeast Michigan is hoping to be one of those places where new solutions emerge to address this crisis. It's called Michigan Advocates for Youth Behavioral Health. Larry Burns is the president and CEO of the Children's Hospital of Michigan Foundation. He's helping to lead this new effort and wrote about it in a recent letter to the editor in Cranes, Detroit. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, Lester. Delighted to be here.
So you wrote, quote, "Our current healthcare system is failing to meet the needs of children with mental health disorders." In what ways?
Well, in many ways. Just to make sure that your listeners are aware that mental health disorders are the most common disease related to childhood, more than cancer, diabetes, AIDS combined. So people need to know that. 1 in 5 children suffer from a diagnosable mental health, behavior health issue. But only 20% of these kids are being treated. And so I like to say that it's not just a problem. It is really a crisis.
Why haven't we recognized this yet?
Well, part of it is the stigma that mental health and behavioral health has still in our society. You know, people are very willing to talk about their heart disease or some cancer. But when it's mental health, adults and children are just much more reluctant to talk about that. And we're making progress, particularly in millennials and younger. And so campuses across the country are finding that students are more likely to talk about their issues than my generation back in the 70s or 80s in college. So I think the stigma has a lot to do with it. And then the other issue is that we just don't train people enough to deal with behavioral health problems. And I'm not referring to physicians as much as I'm referring to teachers and any group of professionals that deal with children in a group setting. And so they just don't know what to do. And so that's part of the problem.
In fact, you talked about across the U.S., not just in Michigan, there's this shortage of behavioral health providers for children. Why would that be the case?
Well, the case is multidimensional in the sense that because of the reimbursement process in the history on behavioral health, there hasn't been an influx of medical students seeking to be psychiatrists. And in medical school, historically, the amount of time medical students spend on behavioral and mental health is just not enough to prepare a primary care physician or a pediatrician in mental health. But because the reimbursement has been poor historically or there's no reimbursement, then a lot of physicians with a lot of debt and a lot of other financial issues haven't chosen these specialties. That's part of it.
So what's the result of a shortage of mental health providers?
Well, the result is, I'll give you an example. At Children's Hospital of Michigan in Detroit, their emergency room on any given day might have 15 to 20 youngsters, so ages 10 to 15 to 18, in their emergency room because of a behavioral health issue. Many of these children, young adults, are in a crisis mode. And because there isn't enough inpatient longer-term beds in the state to send these kids to, many times, if not most, they stay in the ER for days, sometimes weeks. And if you add up the fact that there's a lack of trained physicians, psychologists, social workers, and then you add the fact that there is a lack of inpatient, longer-term beds in the state, then there's nowhere for these children to, I don't say nowhere, but there's not enough places for these children to go to for the type of longer-term care they need. They don't belong in an ER for a week. They belong somewhere where they can get some better care.
There's this old saying that, you know, if you don't put money into one social program, society will pay some other way. It sounds like we're wasting a lot of emergency room space and time and staff when they don't really have the means to deal with the issue at hand.
Yes. There's a number that I just saw that if a child is undiagnosed and continues to, let's say, go to an ER when there's a behavioral issue, the price tag on that during their childhood is $300,000, meaning that is the cost that the hospital and sometimes the insurance company may have to put out there because they're undiagnosed. And so they're not really getting the proper long-term care to help them in a long-term way.
So what will you actively do to deal with the issues that you've just outlined for us?
Thank you, Lester. I might start with just mentioning some of the members of the coalition. So it's Oakland Family Services, an organization called Detroit Live, the Children's Center in Detroit, the International Bullying Prevention Association, which is headquartered in Michigan, but it's an international organization, Wayne State University, Starfish Services, and several others. Most of the members that are in the coalition are frontline service providers. These are people who deal with children and families every day versus me, more as an administrator. We listen to each other. One of the things we've done in the time we've been in existence is breaking down our own silos. These organizations I mentioned, many of them are not aware of one another. They don't work with one another, not because they don't want to, because they don't know maybe how to. So this coalition is going to try to create opportunities to work together. And the first major effort we have will be on May 14th at the Inn at St. John's in Plymouth, Michigan. We are having a child and adolescent behavioral summit where we're covering things from university-aged kids to preschool, and we're going to have topics such as trauma, things as suicide, depression, anxiety, and sort of a whole gamut of things.
Your list of goals included, as we were talking earlier, ending stigma, changing attitudes toward mental health illness. That's a tall order. How do you do that?
Well, I think we do it by starting and by being committed to this marathon. Our foundation is a foundation in perpetuity, meaning that we're going to be around for hopefully forever. These focus areas that we have, and behavioral health being one of them, is allowing us to every day to reach out to organizations. We now have 40 partners in the state where we are working together either by providing money, providing advocacy, bringing people together. And so every day we're doing that. And so we're in it for the long run. These are not short-term fixes. If they were, they would have been done already. And so we're working with the University of Michigan. We're working with Mott Children's Hospital. We're working with the Boys and Girls Club. Just this month, one of our new partners is called Life Labs for Kids. It's in Ferndale, Michigan. It is a new center for kids with autism. So we're very committed to the children and their families that are dealing with kids with autism, and we put that into our mental health, behavioral health category as well. And so we can't do this alone, obviously. We are increasing our resources financially. We're reaching out to organizations and people in the state with our ability to manage money, but then to disseminate that money to our partners.
Larry Burns is president and CEO of the Children's Hospital of Michigan Foundation. He's part of a new coalition called Michigan Advocates for Youth Behavioral Health. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you very much, Lester. Appreciate it.
Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel sent a message to the state's seven Catholic bishops yesterday. She says Michigan's Catholic diocese should stop their investigations into clergy sex abuse. But some church leaders say they're bound by church law to investigate certain allegations. With us now is Monsignor Michael Bugarin. He's the priest appointed by Detroit Archbishop Alan Vigneron to process all cases involving sexual abuse of minors or vulnerable adults by clergy. Welcome to Stateside, Monsignor.
Welcome to be with you. Thank you.
Attorney General Dana Nessel was pretty clear. She doesn't want Michigan Diocese to conduct their own investigations into sex abuse claims while her investigation is going on. What do you make of her request?
Well, I think there's some confusion about the type of investigations that we do. I mean, we are our own law, under church law, to investigate these claims to be able to remove or restrict a priest from ministry if he is found to have a credible accusation and go through a process. We, since 2002, we have had agreements with the county prosecutors where we turn over every complaint, and we always defer to local law enforcement as to whether or not they want us involved or not involved, and it's only after that they conduct their own review of the case do we proceed with our own canonical church law-required proceedings.
So you're saying you would let the civil authorities do their investigation and then you'd follow up, or am I misunderstanding?
No, that's exactly what we do. In the Archdiocese of Detroit, and I pretty much can say for the other dioceses, that's kind of like, that's our process. We turn over things, especially in the Archdiocese of Detroit, we turn things over to the local prosecutors. They will go and say, no, they're going to take up the investigation. Then we follow their lead. They want us involved, we'll be involved. If they don't want us involved, we're not involved.
So for those of us not familiar with church law, why not just let the legal system handle that? Then if you need to dismiss someone or defrock someone, you do that. What is it about canonical law that requires you to do this investigation?
Well, it's only by our law that we're able to remove someone from ministry. We're able to restrict someone's ministry. So we do need to conduct our own review. We have a review board, an independent third party that helps the Archbishop make a determination on whether or not a complaint is credible. So that's the law that we are given to be able to remove someone from ministry. So it's our right to be able to follow that law to restrict, remove someone from ministry. But again, we do not get in the way of local law enforcement.
The Attorney General also made reference to non-disclosure agreements. She said anyone who has signed one should know that they can still speak with authorities. What is the Archdiocese's position on non-disclosure agreements?
So since 2002, we have not had any non-disclosure agreements. We're not allowed to go into those agreements unless a specific victim survivor asks for it. Anyone who was bound by a non-disclosure agreement before 2002, they were told that they're not bound by it anymore in light of our current policies and procedures for the protection of children and young people.
This statewide investigation was first announced by then-Attorney General Bill Schuette back in September. Since then, how's that altered your work in investigating clergy sex abuse for the Archdiocese?
We have cooperated with any of the requests from the investigators from the Attorney General's office. We have turned over all the documents when they came to visit each of the locations in late September, early October. And, you know, again, as complaints come our way that they are not handling, we'll continue to do our own work.
You call them visits. I think some people would call them raids on the seven dioceses. They obtain hundreds of thousands of pages of documents. How do you feel the AG's office has handled this investigation so far?
Well, they're doing their work. We have to do our work. I mean, they came. I was part of that day when they came to acquire all the documents, and we cooperated with them fully, and we have gone on record several times saying that we welcome and we cooperate with the investigation.
So you don't feel like this is an infringement. You welcome the Attorney General's Office investigation.
Yeah, to be able to, you know, it's yet another way for us to say that we're doing everything possibly that we can to protect children and young people. And again, you know, the Archbishop has gone on record, the other bishops have gone on record in the state of Michigan, that we pledge our full cooperation.
This investigation is expected to take a couple of years, that we were told that yesterday. How would you like to see these next couple of years play out between the authorities and the Catholic Church in Michigan?
Well, I think we have a lot to offer the Attorney General's office, too. They're going at it not knowing case files and individuals. And again, we have welcomed and we have offered to be able to sit down and, you know, come to the table to assist them if they so desire. Again, we have offered to cooperate, and it would be nice to be able to have that cooperation on both sides so that, again, we can bring you know, those that need to be brought to justice. We can remove from ministry those that need to be removed from ministry and be able to protect children and young people. That's the ultimate goal.
The Catholic Church in America has been dealing with this issue since 1985. Why haven't we been able to resolve everything a lot faster than we have?
That's a good question. You know, as cases come forward, you know, every time we learn of a new case, you know, it might be other victims that are out there for an individual. A lot of these cases that we're bringing today are older cases from years ago. We have done a remarkable job with training people and mandated reporting, training people through our Protecting God's Children workshops, and hundreds of thousands of people have been trained. So, you know, it's been a learning process and a learning curve for all of us, but I do think that we are getting, you know, we are moving a lot faster than we were many years ago just because it was all new for us.
I think it's fair to say that this clergy sex abuse scandal that's been going on for some time has hurt public trust in the institution of the Catholic Church. What do you see as the road to rebuilding the trust, rebuilding that trust that you had for, you know, a millennia?
Well, I hope people will see and understand that that we are doing things to help right the wrong. We are trying to educate our clergy, educate our lay people. We are doing things to protect God's children. I would like to say we're paving the way with some of our initiatives that have been in place since 2002 when the Charter for the Protection of Children and Young People came out, also known as the Dallas Charter. But again, I think we have come a long way since 2002 in educating and training people. So I hope people will see that. The news and the spotlight is on it right now. Do we have things that we need to do? Sure. We're not perfect at it. And I think it's an opportunity for us to continue to, you know, look inside and say, what other areas can we do better than what we're doing today?
Finally, bishops visited the Vatican this week. The Pope gave some advice on what to do in handling these situations. What do you think of that as far as progress in resolving the issue?
Well, I think the Holy Father calling all of the presidents of the bishops' conference from around the world into one meeting to discuss this issue is very important and an important step in, you know, looking at it from a global perspective. It's not just a problem in the United States. It's something that our legislation, our church law, needs to look at from a global issue. And again, I think we have things that we can bring to the table as far as our educational programs, the Dallas Charter, again, that document that became particular law for us as to how we deal with claims of sex abuse committed by clergy are dealt with in the United States, can become a roadmap for other countries that are dealing with this at the same time.
Monsignor Michael Bouguerin is the priest who was appointed by the Detroit Archbishop to process all cases involving sexual abuse of minors or vulnerable adults. Thanks very much for talking with us.
You're welcome. Glad to be with you.
That is Stateside for today. I'm Lester Graham. Have a great weekend.